You're listening to Solidarity Journal on WAZU. I'm Zach Teague. A lot of things have happened last week in the news, and we're bringing you just a slice of the pie. These are your headlines. Peoria's second largest employer, OSF, is experiencing pressure from its employees to become green. A minority of outspoken employees are finding areas of operation that can be more sustainable, and they are arranging for management to implement new measures, but change is hard. I spoke with an employee this week, and you don't want to miss what David Pittman has to say about the OSF Green Team. As always, we'll have another edition of the Retort Report. We'll bring you new updates on the Illinois state budget and other legislative processes that affect all of us. And in Peoria, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, held a dinner at the Ivy League Country Club. We've got details. The state of Vermont is on the edge of passing legislation for single-payer health care, making health a right of its citizens. We've got some thankful talks and expressions on the issue of single-payer health care for all. All of this and much more. Please stay tuned. This is WAZU 90.7 FM, Solidarity Journal.
We're a rich nation full of hoarded homes, crowded prisons, abandoned schools, poor folks with hard goals, rich folks with poor souls, undereducated, underhomed, underpaid but overloaned, clinging hard to what we own, trying to win the rat race. Oh, so you hate taxes on the working poor, unless of course they're for the war or putting the wall along the border, but not for nurses or doctors. Priorities flip the way it looks to me, and I work hard as hell for my money, but I don't believe in an economy that forces folks to crawl. Tea party on the Capitol lawn, and Sarah Palin singing along, laughing all the way to the Pentagon. Tea party on the Capitol lawn, asking you which side you're on, drawing battle lines in this country. Oh, but there's something about our worldview, something about the lens we look through, that keeps us from building something new that works out better for more of us. Well, it's in the cracks where the levees broke, it's in the cash Goldman Sachs stole, it's in the fields of tomatoes where the legacy of slavery roams. It's a hatred born of jealous fear, a hatred born and bred right here, xenophobic and insecure with a deadly outcome. It's a racism that grows and thrives from religions used to justify an endless list of human rights denied in the name of liberty. Tea party on the Capitol lawn, and the Christian terrorists are singing along, getting ready for the race war. Now you're telling me immigrants should go back home. I say no, the ground that you're standing on, 'cause Arizona was Mexico and your grandparents were European, and your national heroes like Thomas Paine were immigrants when they came and called themselves Americans. And that's how it's always been. No, Marie and Juan didn't steal your jobs, they were outsourced by Bill and Ron, as South America's wealth was robbed by U.S. corporations. So when they dumped the tea in Boston, it was an attack against the corporation. So I don't see the connection between that story and yours, and Christmas addicts and the Boston dead weren't fighting for a white nation. They were fighting an occupation, like the Iraq and Afghan wars. Tea party on the Capitol lawn, asking you which side you're on, drawing battle lines.
Thursday the 12th was the 50th anniversary of the Peoria chapter of the ACLU. Guest speakers included Colleen Connell, the executive director of the ACLU of Illinois, and State Senator Kohler, a senator in our state's General Assembly, received an award from the ACLU. Solidarity Journal's own Bradley Adams was in attendance. He brings us the comments of the speakers and award recipients. Executive Director of the Illinois ACLU, Colleen Connell, mentioned the qualities of our ACLU Peoria chapter, praising our local and national fights and legislation, thanking the members for their tenacity in directly influencing our representatives.
The importance of the ACLU is echoed by the fact that we have chapters really all over the state and all over the country. Peoria chapter of the ACLU has been on the forefront of a range of important civil liberties and issues, from reproductive freedom to LGBT rights to racial justice. And I come here tonight to join the celebration with the Peoria chapter and to challenge the chapter to continue to be the forceful advocates for the Bill of Rights that they are. Toward the chapter's importance on legislative advocacy, the chapter has always been responsive to requests from the Chicago office to contact their legislators, whether it's members of the General Assembly or member of Congress, to urge their legislators to vote the right way. And by that I mean vote in favor of bills such as the Civil Union Bill that the legislature passed them at the end of the last session, or in favor of the death penalty repeal, which the General Assembly enacted in January, or against some of the repressive measures that we see year after year introduced in both the General Assembly and in Congress, measures that would restrict abortion rights, measures that would really assign inappropriately long and non-rehabilitative penalties on juvenile justice issues. The chapter has also been very important in terms of providing a local window into problems that have become the subject of statewide ACLU litigation. For example, our challenge a number of years ago to the conditions in the state-run hospitals for the adult mentally ill. And so there's been a range of activities that the Peoria chapter has been instrumental in fulfilling.
David Kohler, a state senator working in Springfield to give equal rights to gay and lesbian people, was awarded by the ACLU, and Bradley further questioned him on what he plans to do for working men and women in Illinois.
Yes, I was very proud to be able to receive the Sam Belfer Award, a very prestigious award that the ACLU gives out to people who they want to honor for different events, different things that have happened in the life of this community. They honored me for being the Senate sponsor of the Civil Union Bill that passed this last year, so I was very, very humbled by it.
Very good. Congratulations. And can you tell our listeners what you're currently working on that will benefit the workers of Central Illinois?
Well, we're working on jobs. Jobs is number one. We've got to continue to do everything we can to get more people to work. That's what's going to get us out of this recession and back on track. Unfortunately, we've got a deep recession that we're just coming out of, and the state budget is not in real good shape at this point, but we have to do everything we can to continue to promote different projects and aspects of the state that are going to produce jobs for people.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Whoever wins in November, the rivers will flow into the Charles and the Rio Bravo. The nuke dumps will widen and the forests will burn until the time comes when we finally learn that whoever wins in November, neo-lib, neo-con, stands only for death. Whichever face he has on, we will build a new world and set us all free. Once we drive the whole lot of them right out of D.C. Whoever wins in November.
Since the start of this year, the General Assembly, the Illinois House and the Senate, and the Governor's Office have been battling out the details of our Illinois budget. May 31st is the deadline for our state government to establish a budget for the next fiscal year. The House estimates a $33.2 billion budget that includes cuts to for-profit schools by limiting the amount of monetary award program money, also known as MAP grants. For-profit schools will see a decrease in monies awarded to them by students who apply for the grants that help students pay for college. One good thing about this is public schools and not-for-profit schools will be given an incentive to attend, as prospective students will find it easier to pay tuition to them. MAP funds were reduced by $17 million in the House proposed budget, which is the largest cut to the program in history. Human services, general services, and education received cuts in the governor's budget proposal. But lawmakers in the House rejected the proposal and restored millions of dollars to these services, ignoring Governor Quinn. Political scientists suggest that these talks are right on time and shouldn't burden the government operationally or give rise of a shutdown. The parties are nearing agreement and a budget will be chosen on time. Staying on topic with Illinois politics, late last week, Illinois lawmakers passed educational reforms. The reforms make it tougher for teachers' unions to strike. 75% of teachers unionized would have to vote among their members in order to go strike on the picket line. The plan also would make it easier to fire teachers by streamlining the process. Supporters say the 2-year process to fire a teacher would be condensed to 3 to 4 months. The state legislation passed 112-1 and is being praised for its open table, open access opportunity for all parties, unions, lawmakers, advocates, and schools. They all had a hand in shaping the legislation, says Illinois State House News, a member of the Free Press that focuses on the day-to-day affairs of our state legislature. Solidarity Journal plans to communicate with the Illinois Federation of Teachers to better understand any grievances the teachers may have with the bill. Look forward to more updates on this subject. Several healthcare groups at the state capitol have a plan to help people lose weight. They are proposing increasing the tax on soda and other sugary drinks in Illinois. The measure, Senate Bill 396, would add a penny an ounce to the cost of most soft drinks with added sugar or other sweeteners that pack on calories, including soda, sweet iced tea, and coffee drinks. This proposal comes 2 years after the state increased the soft drink tax from 1% to 6.25%. Supporters of the new soda tax say it isn't about more money. Instead, they insist the main goal behind the proposed surcharge is to curb the state's obesity rate. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, 1 out of every 4 Illinoisans is obese. Adding a quarter to the cost of that 24-ounce Pepsi would have a twofold effect. People would think twice before buying the drink, and at least half of the tax revenue would go to a special fund to fight obesity in the state. We'll keep our eyes open as this legislation comes under a vote.
Get you a man that's a union man. Join the ladies' auxiliary. Married life ain't hard. You're packing a union card. And a married man has a happy life if he's got a union wife. So you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union until the day I die.
The United States is the only major nation in the industrialized world that does not guarantee health care as a right to its people. Meanwhile, we spend about twice as much per capita on health care, and in a wide number of instances, our outcomes are not as good as others that spend far less. It is time that we bring about a fundamental transformation of the American health care system. It is time for us to end private, for-profit participation in delivering basic coverage. It is time for the United States to provide a Medicare for All single-payer health coverage program. Under our dysfunctional system, 45,000 Americans a year die because they delay seeking care they cannot afford. We spend 17.6% of our GDP on health care in 2009, which is projected to go up to 20% by the year 2020. Yet we still rank 26th among major developed nations on life expectancy and 31st on infant mortality. We must demand a better model of health coverage that emphasizes prevention and primary care for every single person, without regard for their ability to pay. Let's face it, until we put patience over profits, our system will not work for ordinary Americans. It is incomprehensible that drug companies still get away with charging Americans twice as much or more than citizens of Canada or Europe for the exact same drugs manufactured by the exact same companies. It is an outrage that insurers still often hike premiums 20%, 40%, and 60% a year on individual policyholders, and some insurers still spend 40 cents of every premium dollar on administrative and profits while lavishing multi-million dollar payouts on their CEOs. It boggles the mind that approximately 30% of every healthcare dollar spent in the United States goes to administrative costs rather than to delivering care. We must do better. Taiwan, for example, spends only a little over 6% of GDP on healthcare while achieving better health outcomes on some key indicators than we do, yet they spend a relative pittance on administrative costs. I am very proud that the state of Vermont is now taking big steps to lead the nation in healthcare by moving forward on a plan to establish a single-payer healthcare system that puts the interests of patients over chasing profits. The American Health Security Act would make sure every state does the same, taking profits out of the equation by implementing a single-payer system, but letting each state administer its own program, according to strict standards, in a way best suited to its needs. The goal of real healthcare reform must be high-quality, universal coverage in a cost-effective way. We must ensure, to as great a degree as possible, that the money we put into health coverage goes to the delivery of healthcare, not to paper-pushing or astronomical profits that line CEOs' pockets. Thank the great state of Vermont for leading the nation to sanity, pursuing modernization, and catching us up with the rest of the world.
And we rock, because us against them, we found our own reasons to sing. And it's so much less confusing when lines are drawn like that, when people are either consumers or revolutionaries, enemies or friends, hanging on the fringes of the cogs in the system. It's just about knowing where everyone stands. All of a sudden, people start talking about guns, talking like they're going to war. 'Cause they found something to die for. Start taking back what they stole. Sure, it's every other option.
Hello, my name is Bradley Adams, and welcome to the Retort Report on WAZU and Solidarity Journal, where I catch the conservative spin and set it straight. Recently, the Peoria Journal-Star printed another ridiculous column by George Will, who proves that one can use big words and still have a small mind. This column was titled, "After 7 Decades, Lots to Appreciate About Growing Older." Will and I have very few things in common, a couple of which are that we are both getting older and we both love baseball. He has written not so much an editorial as a 70th birthday card to himself, and takes the opportunity to quote baseball manager Casey Stengel, who said after being fired by the New York Yankees in 1960, "I'll never make the mistake of being 70 again," which for Will, anyway, is better than being dead. He then makes a couple of inane references to the Bible, which we both find sometimes tiresome, but that is possibly the last common thought we may ever have, because his next notion shows how completely out of touch with civil rights this smug old conservative really is. Will believes that he has seen the nation put away the almost casual cruelty of racial segregation and the emancipation of women, and that the nation has decided to declare unthinkable many practices that not long ago were performed unthinkingly. But have we? Is there no segregation in our schools, in our neighborhoods, in our workplaces, in our prisons? Or has the cruelty of racism just become more casual? Has it merely gone underground? Isn't racism now just more informal and indifferent? And are women really treated equally? Are they paid the same as men? Promoted as often? Respected as readily? Are racism and chauvinism unthinkable? Or do they continue to exist with even less thought? Will is grateful to have lived through Pearl Harbor and World War II, as well as the Cold War, and to have arrived at what he calls the sunny uplands of today. He states that although man is still and ever will be born into trouble, never before in the human story has the risk of death by violence been smaller for such a large portion of humanity. What? Is he so secluded in his posh environs to see what violence continues to rage in the streets of Africa, Asia, Mexico, New Orleans, Detroit, Peoria? Are we to agree that since things have worked out so hunky-dory for George Will after 70 years that we can all congratulate ourselves on a job well done? That this is the pinnacle of human existence because of what he terms competent medicine? Ha! Has anyone been treated at one of Peoria's downtown hospitals? Holy malpractice, Batman! Oh, sure, we now have penicillin, originally produced for the masses right here in Peoria. There are also antibiotics and sulfa drugs now. And this is a reminder to Will of what he claims to be America's most pressing domestic problem. Baby boomers on welfare. Talk about your silver linings. Naturally, since we've solved the bigotry and misogyny dilemmas, and drive-by shootings are a thing of the past, we can now turn our sights on what to do with all these old people. An example of aging vigorously, Will quotes America's original retort artist, Mark Twain, who commented, "I am able to say that while I am not ruggedly well, I am not ill enough to excite an undertaker." Today, because of the aforementioned pharmaceutical triumphs, someone in Twain's condition might live for decades, having to choose between paying for their pills and food or heat. And if they're really lucky, their senior moments won't develop into Alzheimer's disease. What a great way to spend your golden years. But to be 70 for someone allegedly in his right mind, like Will, is to understand that time cannot wither, nor custom stale the infinite pleasure of simply trying to do things well, or witnessing others do them. Luckily for him, he doesn't have Alzheimer's. He'll know it, if he gets it, when he suddenly can't figure out how to send his latest column to his editor. What then? Would he still feel so self-righteous? Casey Stengel, who also made the mistake of turning 72, while managing the horrible 1962 New York Mets, asked his team, "Can't anybody here play this game?" To which Will laments, "Few can," which is why the especially talented few delight the many. Does he include himself in this elite group? Probably. He seems happy enough with his situation, and he proclaims that happiness is a talent, and one that, unlike hitting a curveball, anyone can develop. Really? What about the oppressed, the victimized, the disabled, the infirm? Finally, he winds up this delusional series of bromides with a nugget for the youngsters. America truly is something commensurate with our capacity for wonder. One might say the same about George Will. And once again, shame on the Journal Star for publishing such tripe. This has been a bursting of another conservative bubble. Until next week, my brothers and sisters, this is Bradley Adams on behalf of the Retort Report, WAZU, and Solidarity Journal, wishing you a rational nation and not rationalizations.
Oh man, take a look at my life, I'm a lot like you. I need someone to love me the whole.
Local corporate roadblocks to a sustainable life can be found all over our country. In most cases, corporate sellers of goods would rather see us throw things away than recycle them. Many people in our area are fighting to live a more sustainable life. Today we have David Pittman, a local employee of OSF, and he's here to tell us about the OSF Green Team. David, how are you today?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Tell me about the OSF Green Team.
Sure, sure. Well, I've worked at St. Francis Medical Center, which is one of the 160 buildings part of OSF, which covers a couple states. I've been at the hospital since 1991. I've been an environmental activist since probably my mom put me in some kind of ecological diaper. It comes easy to me to be thinking about environmental stuff. It's been hard to do that where I work. St. Francis Medical Center has only in the last few years begun to come around to the realization that sustainability is not just something that tree huggers do. It's something that every business should be doing. I probably should throw out the caveat that I'm here not for St. Francis Medical Center. I'm not talking on behalf of anybody but me. But I'm a pretty talkative dude, so we're going to be chatting for a while. We have about 100 volunteer employees now that have signed up for emails and want to do something voluntarily at their workplace. And that's a list that includes office managers, housekeepers, nurses like myself. Everybody that gets involved wants to do something to help their workplace. Now, here's an interesting thing. I had a meeting the other day with some of the big administrative people at St. Francis Medical Center, folks that make a whole lot more money than I do, folks that drive fancier cars than my Ford Ranger pickup truck. And I asked them a question. I said, how many of you recycle at home? 6 out of 7 raised their hands. How many of you recycle at work? 2 out of 7. Mm. What's that? Well, there's a kind of paralysis, I think, that descends on people when they go to their workplace. The habits, the good habits that they have at home, somehow fail to translate into the workplace behavior. Mm. And that's because of this attitude that everything is the bottom line. Everything's about money. And if you can't give me an immediate justification about how this is going to help our bottom line, well, keep it at home. Mm-hmm. Well, that attitude has got to change, and it has begun to change at some businesses across the across our fair country.
So
it changes slowly. It changes very, very slowly.
So there's a small minority of people who have signed up voluntarily to be sort of spearhead this greening of OSF.
Well, like every organizational effort, it starts with a very small core of people. In our case, probably about 6 folks that are real, real active. But like every good movement, it spreads quickly through communication. You know, as an older guy, I'm in my mid-50s, it's really interesting to work with young people because I understand how well they communicate. It's part of the culture, the minute-to-minute culture of being in touch, being in touch. That's not how I grew up. It's not how most people in their 40s and 50s and 60s think, you know. But it's one of the most hopeful things that's sweeping the planet right now. Look at what's going on in the Middle East. Look at what's going on in America. If we focus just on older people and the old ways of doing things, we're not going to go anywhere very fast because of this lack of communication. With the onset of the electronic media, we have a way, like this radio show, of reaching out to who knows how many, maybe 6.
Yeah, maybe 6 or 7.
But those 6 or 7 are probably going to say, hey, I heard something cool. And I have no doubt that this program can be brought up out of the electronic memory at any time by anyone who's really interested in it. That didn't occur 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So while my words are not golden, while they're not anything fancy, I do think that there's this opportunity now to really reach out in ways that just did not exist before.
So how are you and the employees using new media, the online space of the world, communicate to each other in the local area that OSF is trying to change? Or at least that the employees are trying to change it.
Internet, website, electronic newsletter. It began, though, with some old-fashioned of getting noticed, getting respectability. And so we organized informally and met face-to-face and said, what can we do? And the clear answer that came back is that everybody wanted to get involved in one of the most basic things of environmental sustainability, which is recycling. Everybody who is into the green effort has a little pang in their heart when they see an aluminum can thrown into the trash, and they want to grab that aluminum can and put it into the recycle bin.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, at my employer's place of work, there are no such cans. So one of the things that immediately came out was, we got to start recycling more of this stuff.
So now, just for employees like own waste, it's all just a regular garbage can.
Well, bear in mind, we're talking a hospital. We're talking one of the most highly regulated organizations ever. We are a 24/7, 600-bed hospital that has a huge amount of waste that comes out of it. We are dealing with blood and guts. We are dealing with patient care areas as well as office areas. So you have to start getting into the details. I'm a detail person. We can spend this hour talking about how you go about getting permission to put a container in a hallway, but there may be other things you want to talk about. But it starts with knowing what you want to do and beginning to work through the different levels within the workplace. And so that's what we've been doing at St. Francis.
What are some of the materials that are highly recyclable but aren't recycled?
Well, a good way to begin that is to look at what is recycled at my employer. We probably have about 25 different materials that are recycled now, 100% of the cardboard, maybe 50, 60% of the office paper. There's really no plastic, there's no glass, there's very little that comes out of the operating room, which is the main trash creator in the system. The operating rooms, they wrap everything in blue paper, and then they wrap that in another set of blue paper, and that's to protect the sterile components of what's inside the tools that everybody has to use. Other medical facilities throughout the country have begun to recycle, and so what we're doing is we look at that and we say, let's take a look at Mayo Clinic. Let's take a look at Cleveland Hospital. Let's take a look at Emory University. What are these folks doing? How do they do it? We don't have to reinvent the wheel. There is very much an issue of how much does it cost. But more than that, it's raising the awareness to say, here's something that can be done. The other thing that is not done at our facility is to involve the visitors, the families, in any way, shape, or form. If you've got a loved one in the hospital and you go to our cafeteria and you've got that plastic soda bottle in your hand, mm-hmm. goes into the trash. You have no choice. So St. Francis has begun to hear from people who say, WTF, man,
yeah.
come on. You know, give me a place to just recycle my bottle.
So common areas you want to add recycling to.
So if you're a visitor and you walk into St. Francis, we hope that you'll get a green message. And St. Francis believes that they have such a green message. Look at the $280 million building that was just completed called the Milestone. Got a lot of interesting stuff in it. Photo-sensitive light switches throughout the entire building. Open up the bathroom, the lights come on. That's technology, baby.
And that's green.
Yeah, it's very green.
You don't have to waste energy.
Windows are highly efficient, triple E's. They're beautiful windows. And you can stand on one side of the window on a hot day like today's going to be, and you barely feel the heat coming through that huge 8-foot by 4-foot south side glass. There's some good stuff. It's built very, very well.
But they don't do anything with their waste, and they accumulate a lot of it. And that's kind of like the most important part of the materials cycle.
I would agree they don't do enough. And I would agree that what's really important is to look at sustainability, look at that cycle of from cradle to grave, look at that cycle of from extraction of the natural resources, say the bauxite out of Africa, you know, to the aluminum smelter plants in the southern Canada, to the manufacture of that brand new aluminum can into, sad to say, City of Peoria City and County Landfill.
Yeah.
We need to look at the big picture. And businesses, especially corporations, have tended to focus in on just their simple little bottom line. And that's the mentality that I think the youth of America can break, and that bullheaded, stubborn environmental activists like me have been spending a long time trying to break.
I want to go back to what you said. The operating room mm-hmm. is the most producer of waste.
Mm-hmm. About 40% of our trash of St. Francis comes. There's about 3,200 employees at St. Francis Medical Center. We cover about 9 buildings. And so you can, I mean, we're talking the second largest employer in the county. We're talking a big chunk of what goes in the landfill. But yeah, the operating room has by far, I think, the greatest potential for resource conservation. And it's fairly simple. Instead of wrapping stuff in this fancy blue paper that's sterilized, that comes in tractor trailer after tractor trailer, we can have reusable containers. And the reusable containers, which we use a little bit of and lots of other hospitals use almost exclusively, go back in those tractor trailers to the company that provides us the services, where they clean them, reuse them, sterilize them. And from a federal regulatory point of view, that's all perfectly okay.
So there are alternatives.
There are lots of alternatives. Now, I wouldn't want to pretend to know all of the numbers. I wouldn't want to pretend that if all we're talking about is the bottom line, that it still remains far cheaper to throw away than it does to reduce, reuse, and recycle. But I think it's going to get close. I think as landfill prices go up, as energy prices go up, the idea of having regional-based suppliers to the hospital are going to be more and more popular. And that means that it's going to be easier to take that truckload of used containers back to a warehouse where they get sterilized, cleaned, restocked, and then brought back.
A regional job.
Sustainability, I think, is going to be key to so much around the world, not just in the Midwest, but of course in our society. I think we've grown accustomed to getting vegetables and fruits from all over the world. That's not a sustainable practice.
Yeah, you've got to live and eat locally.
And the more that we do that, the more a synergistic effect begins. The farmer says, I've got a market, I'm going to make it, I'm going to plant an extra acre. The supermarket says, I've got enough different people that I can pretty much guarantee my customers all the tomatoes they want in season. Now, if we're talking oranges, the Midwest isn't going to do so well. And so in that context, the customer has to decide, how many oranges am I going to buy during the season, and how much am I going to pay for them? Self-interest has driven the human race for its entire time, and it will continue to do that. My job as a volunteer, environmental, tree-hugging kind of guy, mm-hmm. is to persuade people in a free market context that, well, maybe you don't need 2 apples. Maybe that organic apple is going to be better for you, and you can keep a little extra money in your pocket. If I can do that, then maybe we can get corporations to turn around, because they'll be driven by what I think is fundamentally a different kind of bottom line,
right.
Their own self-interest, rather than just looking at it in terms of money.
Yes, if they're still remaining competitive, mm-hmm. consumers are choosing them because of their good choices, not because of the price.
Now, you know, I just gave you a segue. You can take that wherever you want.
All right, right.
Okay, go. Well, let's talk about Caterpillar for a moment, because that's the big dog and in our part of the world. And everybody's hoping that, you know, somehow the corporations will see the light. Somehow Exxon or BP is going to suddenly turn green. They want us to believe that, but it's so painfully obvious they're not, that you end up believing nothing about them at all. Caterpillar is a company that is very much in the natural extraction business all over the planet. So you would think automatically that most of what they do is going to be anti-green. They've begun to understand that what they do has got to be sustainable. And so for 10, 15 years, they've been working on the process. A good example is they've got a diesel engine now that is one of the least polluting anywhere, and they're getting more and more market for their product. It exceeds federal standards, has exceeded federal standards for 3, 4, 5 years, and it's that self-interest that's driving Caterpillar. Go to almost any factory in the Midwest, and maybe anywhere in the world that's got Caterpillar on it, and you're going to see green practices there that far exceed my employer, St. Francis. St. Francis wants the business of Caterpillar. We want to be able to say to those employees, you come to us and you're going to get a good price. You're going to get good care. You're going to be taken care of. So we want to Caterpillar to like us. Part of the motivation for St. Francis Medical Center to go green should be business, because it's good for business to be green, especially when your largest employer in the area is way ahead of you. Maybe an interesting thing to talk about would be why corporations don't go green. You know, thinking about BP is a great example, because they've spent many, many millions of dollars on a media project where that says, you know, British Petroleum is the green company. Look at all the green things we're doing in Alaska. Look at all of our alternative energy programs. But when you begin to dissect that, when you begin to look into the reality, what you discover is the typical, sadly typical, false front that the corporation has. The green sheen, I call it, where they want to feel, they want their customers to feel that they're a green company, but the painful reality is something that's very, very different. That pseudo-green was terribly exposed in the Gulf, and mm-hmm. the result of all that has unfortunately been not very much. BP's profits are excessive. You know, Exxon profits are excessive. How can BP possibly claim to be anything other than a blood-sucking corporation? Well, they do. And sad to say, they've got many people who on their side that will say, yeah, we're trying, we're trying. Look at the money they have not paid out to the poor folks in all along the Gulf Coast, the suffering that they've allowed to happen, the profits that their executive managers have made. You know, the stockholders are walking to the bank whistling a good tune. Yeah. You know, it's an insult to all the people of the Gulf. It's an insult to the concept of sustainability to think that anything related to British Petroleum that is calling itself green right now deserves that name. Now, having said that, clearly there are good people within that big corporation trying to do the right thing. You might find one of their buildings that does more recycling than my employer does. But that's really not the point I'm driving at. The point I'm driving at is, what are these corporations about? If they don't understand, like I think Caterpillar has begun to understand, that they've got to sustain, they've got to look past the bottom line of 1 or 2 or 5 years. They've got to look down the road. If they can't do that, then they're driving us all over the cliff. One of the old metaphors is that, you know, the American culture is like a car driving 70 miles an hour towards a cliff with no sense of stopping. We've got to change that. And again, I'm going to come back to the young people and say, they're the wave. That's how this is going to happen. It's not going to happen with the old farts like me, because I've been doing this a long time, you know, and I've only gotten so far. So the message that I want to get out is that wherever you work, whatever you do, you've got to maintain your own internal integrity. Hopefully it's a green sense of integrity, but you are the change.
Now, what about alternatives to fossil fuels?
I think over the next 50 years, do two things. We will continue to require large centralized power stations. There's no way you can run our society and not have some big energy generators, and whether they're going to be gas or coal or nuke is a battle that is now being fought.
Right.
My hope is that we develop new technologies over time that are far less polluting, and that we transition out away from coal, so that someday coal is a four-letter word that's been buried for a long time, because our planet, in my opinion, cannot sustain the use of coal-powered electrical generation.
Do you think technology can save us?
Yes and no. No, because it's us who are going to save us. Us in our choices of buying two apples that are not organic or one that is. You know, we are the people that are going to stop the consuming culture and replace it with something that's a little bit different. We are the people of the world, are the people that are going to say, we're going to figure out a way that we can look at all of the planet and everybody can have some fundamentals. I think those fundamentals are a light bulb, maybe a refrigerator, and a computer. You know, that's not me, that's Tom Friedman talking. But those three essentials, if we can put those into Africa, India, North Africa, we give everybody a chance. We give everybody a chance with a light bulb to read, to have that sense of the future. With a computer, everything's wide open. And then a refrigerator, because that allows you to eat. That gives you the chance to have food. So my vision of the world says, yes, technology is going to save us, but only as it's applied by the people who already have the plan. I'm very optimistic that folks will come up with new technologies all the time. We have to, and we always have. It'd be helpful if the federal government was helping people go to school. It'd be nice if the federal government wasn't fixated on a series of research programs that are only putting money into corporations rather than generating new ideas. You know as well as I do that the profits for the petro giants are unprecedented. Why should they change? If all they see is the bottom line, they're sitting fat, they're happy, even as the planet crumbles around.
Even as oil depletes.
Even as oil depletes, because they'll be there to transition. And if they're able to say, sorry, the oil's gone, but we're here to help you with solar panels on every building, well, then doesn't that make it easier on those politicians to say, well, we're in a crisis, sorry, you know, let's go with the corporations and they can screw us with a new energy mandate that gives them exclusive control. It doesn't have to be that way. One of the great things about alternative energy, solar and wind especially, is that it allows small-scale, regional focus rather than large centralized. As I said earlier, I do believe we need both. We are going to have to stay with some large centralized electricity generating power stations over the next 50 years. But we can transition away from that.
What do you think about Governor Pat Quinn's decide to veto the smart grid? Have you heard of this?
Well, what I know may not be what you know. I know that the ComEd had suggested, and with the support of Ameren, which is our local utility, that if they were to begin to build a smart grid, that they would be compensated for it through taxpayer dollars. They threw in, which I think is what Quinn vetoed, the notion that there would be automatic pay raises that bypass the Interstate Commerce Commission, which traditionally looks at those proposals from utility companies and says, yes, no, we'll give you a part of your request. So, as always, the devil's in the details. It's a little more complicated. It's not that Quinn is saying, I don't want a smart grid. He's saying, I don't want to give a blank check for 10 to 15 years to the corporations, to the utility companies, as to let them build whatever they want. And I think that's right on.
Yeah, it is.
I think corporations have to be controlled. I think that is the key to any kind of success, whether it's environmental success or political democracy expanding throughout the world. The corporations are out of control. If Teddy Roosevelt was alive today, he'd be wielding the big stick.
That's right. The state of Illinois, it's pretty green, wouldn't you say?
No.
No.
No. No.
We do have
I'd say they've got a green sheen going, but you know, and there's some programs that are in the works. Stay with electricity generation for a moment. The state mandated to Ameren some years back that they would require a percentage of their electricity generation to come from alternative solar energy. They also said to Ameren that percentage of your profits has to be put back into energy efficiency. And Ameren, bless their hearts, has tried to do that over the last 3 to 4 years. The bill that was forced through mandated an increasing percentage of profits put back into energy efficiency programs for both primarily residential, but a little bit for commercial. That all occurred. That's all good. That's all small potatoes. Small potatoes. Fact is that we live in, well, in my opinion, it's not a fact, we live in a highly corrupt culture, political culture, where pay to play is commonplace on local as well as county as well as regional levels. And that institution will have to be broken somehow. It won't be broken anytime soon. A good guy like Pat Quinn cannot break it. He's just a player. And so, no, I would not agree that the state of Illinois is green at all. In fact, the state of Illinois just okayed another coal to gas electric generating plant down in the southern part of the state through this last session. The proposals for nuclear power are constantly surfacing. Of all the antiquated technologies, of all the obviously dangerous technologies, Illinois has yet to get that message. We have seven nuclear power plants, most of which are very old, most of which are going to need something, and nobody's looking at that at all. All they're talking about is, well, maybe we should build some more. Illinois has a long, long way to go, and it has to begin with fighting corruption.
Well, I like your ideas of regulating corporations. Is that all we need to have, is big business out of government, and we could have a impartial government of the people who can maintain order in their marketplaces?
Right now I'm reading The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbons. It's a kind of a slow read. It's my second time trying to get through it. Many of the questions that confront our culture have been confronted by other cultures throughout the past. Technology obviously wasn't to the same degree in the Roman Empire, but it was by far the most technologically advanced culture on the planet at the time. You know, the things they did left all the other people in awe. They didn't send people to the moon, but they moved water from the mountains to the cities through their aqueducts, the things that had never been built before. So there are parallels that you can look at all the time with the Roman Empire. You know, the problem, I think, is not just the corporations. I think the problem really has to do with how people interact with each other. You know, we need to develop a more sophisticated democracy, what I would say, I would term participative democracy, in order to really solve the fundamental problem.
Direct democracy?
If you go to school, you got to learn about democracy. You got to learn not just about it, how it was back when those rich white slaveholding guys were creating this wonderful document, but you also got to do it in school. You got to live it. You got to be able to interact with people of different opinions, different colors, different ethnic, different economic backgrounds, and come up with a mutually agreeable solution. That participative democratic process is sadly sorely lacking in our culture. That's what we've got to find. That's what the people of Libya and Tunisia and Egypt have to find. Their struggle is not my struggle, but I support their struggle because we're working for the same goal. We want to have something better for ourselves, something we want to find someone to hook up with and be happy together. We want to have kids, some of us, and see where that goes. So that participative democracy, I think, is the fundamental key. The corporations are just a roadblock in the way.
I think really the individual consumer-driven culture of this throwaway mindset is kind of what blocks us from participating in democracy fully. That's just my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're inundated by advertising and you're told what to like, what to buy, how to act, who to be, it's sold to you, and you can purchase it freely, it gets in the way of changing anything. It makes you apathetic to any other thing except for yourself and your satisfaction and these things that are easily obtainable that you can just toss out when you're done with them.
It's very true. Madison Avenue marketing has been around about since the turn of the century, call it 120 years now. It's grown increasingly sophisticated, and it's increasing in its ability to manipulate consumers. We are more than what we consume.
That's
and
right.
Finding that interplays is key to much of the work that I do. That example, again, of the two apples versus the organic apple, that's finding some way to get past that barrage of advertisements, to get away from a Walmart mentality and to get into a mentality that says, What do I really want? What's good for me? What's the quality that I want? Whether humans will ever get to the point of being selfless, I don't think so. I think we are, when I think of participative democracy, I think of a way where we are not so much no longer selfish, but that we're able to see another person's selfish point of view and see that we're not going to change them too much. We're just going to find some kind of place that'll work, whether it's I'll scratch your back on this decision and then you scratch my back on this other decision. It's not about the corporations, and for me it's a real challenge about education, because it comes back to how do we bring people up. Most folks are pretty skeptical these days about everything. The Tea Partiers, those that are genuine, are so angry that all they see is themselves. They don't understand that the world has changed far, far more dramatically than anybody ever perceived. But the notion of America survives. The notion that we can sit down and talk in a town hall and solve our problems of government, I think, is stronger than ever. You know, the wave that sweeps the country, sweeps the world in 2011 is not going to go away. The drive, the desire for people to be free of tyrants is the thing that created our country, and it's all over the world. It's a beautiful time to be alive.
David Pittman from the OSF Green Team. Messages of hope for a greener tomorrow. Thanks, Dave.
Ciao, baby.
That's our show for this week. I hope you liked it. Thanks for giving me your attention this hour. Send any and all feedback to me, Zach Teague, at live.com. That's ZACKTEAGUE at live.com. From ICC and WAZU, this has been Solidarity Journal. Tune in next week. Peace and solidarity.
Old man, look at my life. 24 and there's so much more. Live alone in a paradise that makes me think of two. Love lost, such a cost. Give me things that don't get lost, like a coin that won't get tossed, rolling home to you. To mean that much to you.